Hello and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures Podcast presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Socialmarks, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, economy, and policy, and reframing how we build for resilient futures.
Hello, everybody. I'm Marco Annunziata, co-founder of Annunziata and Desai Advisors. I'm an economist. I started my career at the International Monetary Fund, then I worked in finance, and then I was the chief economist at GE when I worked a lot on digital industrial technology. So my expertise is really the intersection of macroeconomic trends and innovation and technology. And today I'm joined by my co-host, Vic Shyam of NASA. Vic, over to you.
Hey, I'm Vic. I've been at NASA for about 15 years. I'm currently the futurist for the Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project, or CAS. And my background's in aerospace, biomimicry, and foresight. Back to you.
Thank you, Vic. And our guest today we're very excited about is Mansoor Hanif. Mansoor is a renowned technology leader and visionary with over 25 years of experience in telecommunication and emerging technologies. He's worked in the application of innovation on the regulation side. He has tremendous experience, which he has already brought to bear on a number of very important projects, including most recently and until about a month ago or so, NEOM, the futuristic city in Saudi Arabia that we're going to talk about during the course of our podcast. Mansoor, it's great to have you with us. Welcome to the podcast. And if you want to kick us off by telling us a little bit more about yourself.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me. I'm really excited to join you today. And I would just add that I'm somebody who really believes in technology as a force for good. And I have all of my life. And I still believe it today, and I'll believe it in the future. That doesn't mean that technology is just going to be good by itself, but it really depends on the people who are building it, who are designing it, who are regulating it, who are managing it and implementing it, which is all of us. So this is what I've tried to do in my career, is to effectively be what we call in the cricket world an all-rounder, to be able to look at technology and its impact on society from every angle and just make sure we're doing the right thing and keep ourselves honest. So I believe that passionately, that's what's led me around the world, with some experiences building networks initially, and then from there to building research labs and then regulators, and then this fantastic giga project that you mentioned, NEOM, which is where I was for the past 4 years of my life.
That's fantastic. It's a fantastic way to start. And you know what you pointed out, your faith in technology as a force for good is especially important these days where we are all excited about a range of technologies, but we are also increasingly cognizant of the dangers that these technologies bring to bear. I'm thinking especially of artificial intelligence most recently. But Mansoor, let's start from your experience at NEOM, where you played a very, very important role. And NEOM is exactly an experiment in trying to bring technology to be a force for good and reshaping how we work and how we live. So a very interesting experiment in reshaping the interaction of humans and technology. So we understand you're not longer in that role. So you're speaking in a personal capacity, and that is clear. But why don't you tell us a bit more about your experience there and the lessons you take away?
Yes, I'd love to. And yes, effectively, I'm no longer part of NEOM, so these are my personal views, but it's my personal love for NEOM that you will hear. It's my personal passion about the NEOM vision, which is never going to change because, as I said when I left my colleagues last month, I said physically I'm leaving NEOM, but NEOM is not something, it's not something you close the door on and you just throw the key away. It's not something that you walk through and then you walk out and that's it. It's much bigger than that. It's a vision. It's a vision of the future that lives in my heart now today and will always live there. So one way or another, I'll always be trying to make the NEOM vision a reality because it's something that's going to take, it's going to go on for a long time. It's something that's huge in scale and scope. But fundamentally, what drew me to NEOM is its simple mission. You know, simple things are always the best, you know, and it's an accelerator of human progress. That's what I was told. This is what the CEO Nadmi told me when he interviewed me. Oh, it feels like decades ago. It's 4 years ago in London. And effectively, that's what it's all about. And when I heard that, I thought, I have to be part of this. This is what I've been doing all my life, you know, to be helping technology in particular to accelerate human progress in all of its diversity and beauty. So maybe I should first of all clarify for those of you who don't know about Neom, what is it? Although I'm pretty sure most people will have heard something about Neom over the last 4 years. So Neom is effectively, it's what people call a giga project. It's the flagship of the 2030 vision for Saudi Arabia, which is the transformation of the whole country and the whole region, creating new opportunities for everybody in the region and everybody from around the world who wants to create a new future. It's a region within Saudi Arabia. It's about the size of Belgium. It's in the north west corner of Saudi Arabia. So effectively, it's the closest to Europe. And it borders with Jordan to the north and just across the Red Sea with Egypt across the water. So it's effectively a bridge between three continents. And it's got a lot of advantages. Strategically, it's got a fantastic climate. It's a lot drier than Dubai, for example, or the Emirates on the other side of Arabia in the Gulf. I found it very pleasant there. I mean, I spent 4 years there living in Neom physically. And the climate is very palatable. It does get hot in summer. There's no doubt about that. But it's a couple of months rather than, 5 or 6 months. And it's effectively, it's got a huge investment coming from the Saudi state, but also from private and public companies around the world to build a number of regions within Neom. The largest region, which is the city where people will live, is called the Line. That's where the urban population will live. And this is where I worked on for the last year before I left. But there are other regions. There's the mountain tourism region called Trigina. There's Oxagon, which is the logistics hub and future manufacturing center. And there are some touristic areas that are being built along the coast in the Gulf of Aqaba. You may have seen the names of some of these hotels and developments over the past 6 months. And also the islands. The most famous island that's being developed at this point is Sindara. So that gives you an overview of what Neom is. And it's effectively an accelerator of human progress. There's 15 sectors that are being developed, as well as the regions. The regions are, as I said, they're very focused around their specific role in that overall region of Neom. But we've also got economical sectors that are being developed. And it's very important that the whole project is sustainable and creates these ecosystems of the future around these 15 sectors. And one of those sectors is tech and digital, which is now being named as Autonomous, which leads that ecosystem. That's where I initially started to work. But there's also Enewa, which leads on energy and water. There's the food sector that's recently been spun off as an entity. So each of those sectors is being created as a separate entity within the grouping of Neom to develop their specific ecosystems in each sector. Hopefully that gives you a little view of what it is, but I would really recommend you go and check out the website of what is Neom, and there's a lot more information there. Very hard to say more in a few minutes.
No, that's why I did not even try and I left it to you, because it is indeed a challenge. But I think you put it best. It's really a pathway to the future and really a huge experiment in how we can harness technology for a reshaped and more sustainable way of living and more sustainable relationship between humans and technology, which is something where Vic has a lot of expertise. Vic, do you want to jump in on this?
Sure. I just had a question on, so Masoud, you said you're not with the project anymore, but you believe in the vision. So how is this different from, so there have been many smart cities in the past that have been proposed in the vein of sustainability, like Masdar City, and there's plenty of places elsewhere that maybe they start off with this vision and then gradually there's a realization that maybe from an economic standpoint or from the sustainability standpoint, they're not able to meet their goals or something happens like that. What's the difference, do you think, with Neom? And I guess for most people, it might be counterintuitive to think of a smart city and sustainable city in the desert, right? But I'm assuming the idea is abundant solar energy, but at the same time, there is a large infrastructure requirement. And the other side of it is, again, clean slate, which, you know, sounds great. So anyway, there's all these trade-offs that seem like you have to weigh against each other. So how do you, like, what's justification, I guess, in your mind?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few really good questions in there. So, but first of all, I mean, looking at the examples of other cities, such as Maldar, and others that are springing up at the moment, I think the first difference is the huge scope and scale of what NEOM is doing. As I said, you know, it's the size of Belgium. And even though it's got these 15 sectors and the multiple regions that are going on in parallel, and, you know, clearly there needs to be some degree of prioritization for this project, which is going on at the moment. It's still amazing that there's a very strict guideline that only 5% of the territory will be allocated for urban development. And 95% is going to be completely protected. And that's really important as well to understand that there's a real commitment from the very top management to make sure that the sustainable goals and the protection of nature and sustainable development is first and foremost and is not compromised. So, you know, I can guarantee you that there's been a lot of debates about how best to use that 5% of the land. One of the results of that is this, the design for the cognitive city, we call it, not the smart city on the line, which is very efficient in terms of land usage. And it has some, you know, challenges in the way it's being built that is very different to cities today, which is part of the living lab, which is NEOM. So the scale is just on a different proportion. If you look at the size of NEOM compared to other giga projects, even in Saudi Arabia, you know, there's nothing that comes to the scale of NEOM in terms of its scope and its investment. The other thing is, you know, it's certainly, you know, there's room for learning from what happened in other areas and make sure it doesn't happen here. Having a very committed and sustained long-term vision, which is cognizant of the fact that this is not going to be done in a day, is very important. And you can see that through the messaging that's coming out from NEOM, that this is a long-term project. We're starting off now. It's coming out in phases. And I think that bodes very well for the future sustainability of the project as a whole. As we go through this decade, it's just going to be the phase one of NEOM. It's just the beginning. I think the biggest other factor I would highlight here is the detailed analysis and data-driven approach that's behind the commitments for sustainability. NOAA have got a very clear vision of what can be achieved in terms of sustainable power. And they're very confident that we can, you know, achieve in NEOM 100% renewable energy. But that's based on the existing studies of the advantages of the region of NEOM, where between solar and wind, they're very complementary in NEOM. The wind is very stable at night. And of course, the sun goes down at night. So you need it to be stable at night to compensate the sun not being there. The solar intensity is among the highest even in Saudi Arabia. So the power you're getting through the day is extremely high. And if you put that together, then I think if I recall in the beginning, they were saying something like 77% of the renewable needs could be built directly from solar and wind. And the 23% is the challenge, which is similar to the other challenges that other cities and regions are going through at the moment in terms of, you know, how do you cater for the last 23%? And there's another number of options there between energy storage of various types, battery storage or gravity storage or many other forms of storage. But there's also the great opportunity for green hydrogen. And that's one of the things that has already been committed to and announced by NOAA, which is the biggest ever investment in the green hydrogen generation plant in NEOM. So I think with the emergence of green hydrogen as a viable alternative for a lot of these energies, plus the efficiencies that are coming through in energy storage, it's a whole different world today in terms of what can be achieved than when projects like Masdar kicked off a long time ago. Hopefully that gives you some idea of the data-driven approach that's behind this that gives a lot more confidence that this is going to happen. But nobody's saying it's easy. There's a lot of mistakes that are going to be made. There's a lot of learning is going to be made. But this is the whole thing about the approach in NEOM as a living lab where we can try out different approaches. And this is what I loved most about Neon was the fact of being able to just speak to these, you know, these specialists in their fields and just throw out some crazy ideas. And you know, they would listen to you, you know, which is not usually what happens in most projects around the world.
So a lot of this, you mentioned the term cognitive city. I'm guessing with your background in telecom, what's the big role that telecom has to play in this? And I guess more broadly, when we're talking about the different iterations of, like talk about 4G, 5G, 6G, now people are talking about 6G with, you know, AI and everything's connected. How closely tied are the goals to the, like, enabling this vision of 6G and everything being connected?
Yeah, great. That's another great topic. So I wouldn't say the goals are closely connected. I do believe that the vision of 6G is still forming from the telecoms ecosystem. And I think they're still in search of a mission. And, you know, when I was at NEOM, I put forward my vision of that. And I said that the, you know, 6G should be the cognitive generation. It should be enabling cognitive cities such as the ones that are planned in NEOM. So there is a link, but it's not hardwired. It's a choice that can be made in terms of where do we want 6G to go. But if you look at the development of generations, and I've been lucky enough to be involved in this fantastic telecoms industry since 2G, you know, obviously 2G, people today don't really know what it was, but it was a huge step forward for mobile communications around the world. It took me around the world, and it certainly changed completely the way people communicate. 3G was hyped up to be the entry into real seamless data, but it never really was robust enough for it to happen. And partially that was because there was a lot of, a lot of governments took a lot of money out of the licensing ecosystem just at the wrong time when the investment was needed after the internet bubble crashed. So it took a long time to get off the ground. And then 4G was the one I was most excited about. It was, you know, I was working in Orange, Moldova at the time in Eastern Europe and had the chance to really build a 4G network end to end from the screws right through to the core network and play around with it. And it was just so amazing. It was such a big step forward that I thought, this is it. This is the stable mobile internet that we always wanted and scalable. So it was a big step forward. Then with 5G coming along, there was a bit of a soul searching in terms of, well, you know, once you've done everything, what else do we need to do? So I think 5G was in need of a use case, and effectively where the industry focused was, what are all the things today that people say we can't do that we can try and address and make it the kind of Swiss knife of networks, being able to address all of the different use cases. However, I think 6G now, in my personal view, again, it's still forming. It's a different case where I think it really should be, 6G should become a platform whereby it actually enables new use cases that don't exist today, rather than trying to pull out use cases that we can't do with existing technology. You see, it's a big step forward. And that's really where I think it can really be exciting to people, because otherwise it's going to be a lot of marketing hype, you know? And this is what I meant by it's the cognitive generation, because what we were aiming to do in NEOM, or what they are aiming to do, is very much to create new experiences centered around the human that we simply cannot get in smart cities today. So if we look at smart cities today, and if we're honest about it, you know, it's disappointing, right? We've never really got what we wanted out of smart cities. And people often still get confused when they say, well, where is the smartest city? Well, you know, what's a great smart city? And people talk about Singapore or, you know, Helsinki, and there's some great cities out there with a lot of digital tech. But they misunderstood that the smart city name was being used for a city that is completely smart. Whereas what you actually have is you've got a whole bunch of use cases that depend in each city and are different in each city. The reality is there is no smart city today. There is no city that you can go and say, this is a smart city. This is a city that really gets it. And what we get is we get a lot of very poor experiences. And I have to say, some of the dumbest experiences that I've had in cities around the world are so-called smart city experiences that really make you angry and frustrated. And, you know, I hate it, you know.
Give us an example without leaving the city.
I was actually going to ask you, one of the things I was going to ask you is, given your, so you worked in different like different regions of the world in this telecom industry, right? So I was going to ask you, you brought up the biggest failures or the biggest frustrations. So what are some patterns you see of failure across, let's say, smart cities and maybe in the telecom industry that you've seen?
Yeah, and here I'm not criticizing my good friends and colleagues in the telecom industry, or they'll beat me up. There's a lot more of them than there is of me. But what I'm saying is it's just not easy, right? There's three things that are missing to make smart cities really smart today. One is you need to get a coherent level of connectivity across the whole city. Otherwise, you simply can't scale up to smart experiences because they work in this area, but they won't work there because we couldn't get fiber here, we couldn't get there. And that the reality is it's absolutely terribly hard to roll out consistent fiber and 5G networks today across cities because you've got all of these landlords that are very difficult to reach and that now in most cities in the world, they're mostly millionaires. And so it's really hard for them to even get interested about allowing access to you for your fiber, your antenna. So first of all, it's really hard to get a cohesive, robust connectivity across these cities because of the landlord issue. Secondly, you have too many data silos. And effectively, partially that's due to the fact of different systems being rolled out in different parts of the same city. But it's a lot of that is to do with human politics and people just not wanting to share. And of course, concern about privacy and trust. So the data sharing that's required to make these experiences really smart simply hasn't happened. We're only using about 5 or 10% of the data that's collected. And we don't even know what's happening to it. And the third thing is there's been a lack of standards. There's been a lot of the providers of smart city infrastructure have tried to lock people into their systems in the past. This is now gone now with the latest systems that are coming out that are open. So people understood that we need to be open and we need to be able to interconnect with all types of sensors, et cetera. So that's completely changed now. That's very exciting to see. So, but that has been a block in the past. And the fact that each city, if you take a city anywhere in the US or even a city anywhere in the UK, the role of the city itself is different. It's not a standard thing. So the applications they will have in each city is going to be different. So you can't really scale it up. And that's been really frustrating for telecoms operators and hasn't been able to scale. So the reason why I was excited about NEOM, and I think it's also true for a lot of the new cities that are springing up in the Middle East and any new development, is to be able to build it from scratch. And so as we're designing the city, you can build the infrastructure as it comes, making sure that it becomes like a utility, just like water and energy and waste disposal. It's built in that you simply have to have the connectivity. That gives you that muscle and that bedrock, which allows you to have seamless experience. Secondly, building the data architecture from the beginning and forcing the ecosystem to connect to an open data architecture removes the silos. And effectively, in NEOM, at least, and in many of the new developments, you are effectively the landlord, or you are in really good terms with the landlord, which means people can understand the need to make sure that the connectivity is there, the bedrock. So I think the first thing there is to get to the level where you get this consistent experience across the whole city on which you can really automate and really build advanced applications. Then you build the cognitive stuff on the top.
You touched on a few different things here. So the vision sounds great. So you're talking about this, like the universal connectivity of where there's this infrastructure like water and energy that everyone has access to. But on the other side of it, if I were to play devil's advocate, so if this is automated, and let's talk about, say, the vision of the 6G, right, where you have AI built into the architecture of everything and it's managing stuff. You mentioned this regulation and the standards. How do we know who's benefiting from it and who's controlling the network? I mean, in theory, everything is open, but I mean, there's some architecture built in, there's some bias built in. And who's paying for that infrastructure? And how do we know that the rewards are being distributed?
Great question. And yeah, effectively, it's not all about technology. And that's why, you know, I feel so fortunate to have the regulatory background. And so when I looked at the building blocks of the cognitive city of the future, some of them are technology platforms. Some of them are getting the basics right, which is what I discussed about how we fix smart cities at the bottom, get the muscle there. But a lot of them are regulatory. So you definitely need to have a data sharing and privacy regime, which works for the citizen and enables trust. So you need to have a transparency around that, and you need to go probably beyond GDPR to effectively allow a greater degree of sharing in the public interest, but in a way that the citizen feels trust, feels that he can trust this regime and can effectively raise a complaint if he feels that his or her data has not been used properly. The way I look at this is, today we feel a bit like, some people don't like this analogy because it's a bit slimy, we feel a bit like snails kind of navigating through a city, and we're leaving behind, you know, a snail trail of data. It's no longer ours, you know, but everybody can see it. Anybody can use it. We don't know who's got it. We don't know what they're doing with it. And I feel that way. I'm sure you do as well. What we'd like in the future is a regulation which makes sure that you feel that you have a data halo, which is your data halo, which is around your head. And it's always with you, and you can see as much or little of it as you want to at any time. And you can also allow others to see it as you want to at any time. And this is the kind of, you know, I can't go into too much detail, but it's the regulatory framework and the technology that backs that up that is emerging today that will, first of all, you know, take us to the next step. Mm-hmm. That's part of it. On the AI, it's a great question as well. There's a lot of issues around AI, responsible AI. So I do think there's a need for an AI ethics council on a city level or on a national level, depending on your situation, whereby there needs to be an analysis of the things that we are building and doing to make sure that they're being doing the public good and that the good outweighs the bad. I can't go into details of what was discussed in NEOM, but this was an active area of discussion I was actually contributing to. And I know many organizations around the world are doing that. But that's a really important, it's really important that we're clear about what is the outcome of what is the social impact of what we're trying to do? And is the public in agreement with that? And how do we communicate to people about that? And I really don't think we should have any closed loop boxes that run the AI in a city. What I really believe every city, my personal view, there should be an AI orchestration layer. That's where the ethics should be built in. And only AI systems that meet the ethical requirements of the citizens or of the city or the mayor or the council can be integrated there. And we should never have a single AI running the whole city. There's obviously going to be many different types of AI systems, and it needs an orchestration, and it's through the orchestration that needs to be the transparency and the trust of the citizen. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. Maybe Marco has some questions. I just wanted to clarify for people, we use acronyms. So GDPR is the General Data Protection Regulation. I guess in the EU has that, so for people to control their data, whether it can be erased, restored, and stuff like that, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, correct.
That's correct, Vikin. I was going to jump in with an additional question on this, Mansoor, because the other issue that comes up in what we were discussing right now is cybersecurity, because you make a smart city, you're also presumably opening up a whole new range of vulnerabilities. So I'm curious on your views on how is the best way, what is the best way of addressing it, and to what extent it creates trade-offs with the other issues we were mentioning before.
Well, you're absolutely right. There's a lot of trade-offs there, but I think I would flip your question slightly the other way around. And actually, this is a type of question I would get when I was in Ofcom as well, when they were saying, but look at 5G and look at what you're trying to do in smart cities, et cetera, and cognitive cities. You're increasing the risk. You're increasing the cybersecurity risks and the privacy risks, et cetera. You're increasing the footprint. And I would say, no, actually, we're not, because the footprint is increasing every single day all around you. And it's increasing with so many types of IoT devices and connected devices. And, you know, I've lost count of how many connected devices I have in my house. I'm sure you have as well. There used to be a time when we could count them. There was 8, 10, 12, 15, now God knows how many. And it's only going to increase. So it's happened. The footprint is increasing. What we can do on the municipal level or city level or on the cognitive city level is create a framework to actually manage those devices through gateways and through certain standards, et cetera, to make them safer. Cybersecurity has completely changed from my old days when we were like a fortress, you know, back in the old days of telecoms where, you know, you'd have these firewalls and everything else, and you'd be hiding behind them, and you think the bad guys are outside and we're not going to let them through. We're going to pull up the moat. We're going to put them, never get through the firewall. And then, you know, once you realize how ubiquitous networks are, and this is maybe like about 10 years ago, you realize, forget that. The enemy is already there. The enemy is within. It's already inside. The walls, et cetera, are nice to have for big things, but you must assume that the attackers are already inside. And that allows you to completely re-architecture the way you look at cybersecurity. And effectively now, most organizations, you know, take that approach. And it's a lot about effectively putting in enough monitoring activities that respect the privacy of the citizens, but can give you a really good pattern of normal and not normal behavior for devices so that you can quickly detect anomalies. And then you should have a kind of a lockdown system, which is very effective and very quick to quickly shut down incidents as they happen, like an airlock system, you know. So this is the way, but overall, you need a security framework and a security guidelines that are ubiquitous across the whole city so that people understand whatever types of devices are being deployed of whatever format and standard respect the baseline of the city. The one thing that I think has changed, I mean, there's new technologies that are coming out that can support us. One thing that's really changed the risk actor is AI itself, where, you know, if AI is driven by data and a cognitive city is driven by AI, it's no longer sufficient to make sure that nobody's stealing your data or that nobody's, you know, looking at your data. You need to be 100% sure that your data is still correct. It's not being manipulated, because that's how you take over the horse and you ride it where you want it to without you even knowing. So that's really data integrity and the transmission of data across the city is the biggest area of vulnerability, I think, for AI-driven systems. The good news is that with one of the technologies that I'm very keen on, which is quantum key distribution and protection, allows you the possibility to be sure that your data is integral, has not been seen, because as we know what happened to Schrodinger's cat, once you've seen the photon, it changes form. So that's really critical, I think, for future networks in cities that are driven by AI.
I'm curious about one thing, and hopefully this doesn't take us off track, but we're talking about the potential of smart cities and the potential of the true smart city is exceptional because, as you were pointing out, Mansoor, if you make it really smart in the sense of being underpinned by essentially ubiquitous, coherent connection, and then building a cognitive layer on top of it, you can enable a whole set of services that could really make life a lot more pleasant, efficient, healthy, sustainable for all of us. Now, and as you pointed out, the advantage of experimentation in new cities like NEOMS is exactly that you can build the infrastructure from the bottom up. Now, there is this almost pushes you in the direction. I'm thinking of broadening our discussion here to the challenges that we see around the world, especially in developing markets, where you could almost make two different arguments. One is that this idea of the potential of the smart cities becomes an argument for a greater push towards urbanization, more bigger cities, because that's where we can implement the technology. On the other hand, the beauty of digital technology is also that it enables a more distributed approach. And so it can help us bring the solutions to a more distributed settlement of the population, so to speak. And so I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on this trade-off, and especially in terms of the future of cities, the future of economic development around the world, and the sustainability aspect of this. How should we be thinking about it?
Yeah, another great question. I think from my perspective, I really believe in the creator economy. And I think that the distributed technologies that we're focusing on now, most of us now call it Web3, it's got a huge potential. I'm very, very passionate about what Web3 can do to empower people wherever they are, you know, in the rural areas, in the urban areas. The demographic forecasts are really clear, though, at the moment, which is that cities will continue to increase. That's what the forecast is. And I think that's inevitable, but it may be more of a fluid thing where people go to the cities and come out from the cities. But what we really need to do is to give opportunities for people wherever they are. And this is why I was very passionate of building our OneWeb JV, which is a LEO satellite JV that we did with NEOM and OneWeb that is now up and running. I'm still on the board of. And as part of that, we had the, you know, we had the goal to create that connectivity across the whole of Africa. And then through that connectivity, empower local schools and give the opportunity for refugees or for local populations in areas that don't have connectivity to access digital technologies and get the training they need. And there's a few great organizations out there that are doing that today. So once you get that opportunity, then and you create a creator economy whereby anybody can create content and get an economic return based on that content, just based on your pure human creativity, then you're equaling the opportunities in a way that has never been done before. And it's one of the biggest issues with the internet today is that it's really being taken over by the big elephants in the room who have been really good at doing what they do to the extent that they've gobbled up the creativity. And now there's only four or five big companies that basically, you know, manage everything. Web3 gives us the opportunity to empower citizens. And this is what I really think cognitive cities should do. The cognitive solutions that I'm talking about shouldn't be built by the cities. They're enabled by a platform that gives access to the basic building blocks of AI, data, robotics, AR to citizens who can then simply build those applications on the top with the power of Web3 behind it, which will also allow a fair distribution of the gains from that. And that's what I'm really, really passionate about. I think that's the future of giving opportunities across all areas, rural and urban.
If you were to broaden the discussion, so you start talking about global, so you look at aerospace, I guess. What might be the impact of this? You're talking about this new, like the Web3 and this convergence of physical and digital. What might be the impact on the aerospace sector? And then, I guess, along with that, what might be the roles of organizations like NASA in the public discourse and regulation and coming up with these frameworks and building blocks and such?
Yeah, you have a fascinating position there with NASA as you look forward to 2030 and ecosystems. And I think in a way, it's very similar to the internet situation, whereby if you look at 2030 and where you need to be and making sure that you have a healthy, robust ecosystem that gives opportunities to everyone in a fair way, you know, I think there's some challenges there because if you look at what's happening today with some of the big companies in that domain, they certainly have a similar situation to the big internet players, yeah? And they're facing challenges in their supply chain and their performance, et cetera. And I don't need to name any names, so I think we all know that. That's a really big challenge, you know? And some of the new startups that are coming into the world, like, I mean, I have a big admirer of Elon Musk and what he's done with SpaceX and Starlink. Fantastic. But an end-to-end integrated, you know, vertically integrated supply chain is perhaps not the most robust and resilient ecosystem to build. So I do believe that, you know, there's a lot of learnings from the telecoms industry, which has been hammered and is going through a total transformation today because it was locked up by a few big players. They were all vertically integrated. That gave us the best, you know, bang for buck in terms of economies. And now they're going through a very painful transition to software-defined networks and broader ecosystems. And it's really hard to get all these smaller pieces to work together seamlessly. And it's going to take maybe a decade. But the goal is effectively to never be locked into that and have an ecosystem that works for everybody and is more open. I think in the space industry, I know that NASA has done a lot of developments in that area. But I think it's a good model to look at. And it's, but it's not something that's easy to do and comes with a lot of pain and a lot of work in terms of making sure that things can still interwork if they're not vertically integrated.
Got it. So being more distributed and, so I guess more tokenized, open, transparency throughout the network, that enabling more people to play in the ecosystem, I guess.
Well, I guess tokenization is one aspect of the digital. I mean, I'm very, very keen on tokenization, way beyond, you know, crypto, but it's really about giving people empowerment and value from what they create and making sure that people can, for example, if I create a piece of content for whatever platform, I created on Facebook or on Roblox or whatever, I should be able to monetize that across all the platforms, you know? So that's what I'm talking about in terms of digital assets and giving that back to the creators. And I think that's where the cognitive cities would really be built, when we give that platform to the citizens and they can create this content and they can solve the issues of the municipalities through human ingenuity. I think for the aerospace industry, it's more about having a healthy supply chain with enough people in the chain that are, you know, you're certified and secure, but at the same time, don't lock you into situations which are very difficult to get out of, and having a more diversity in that, which is where telecoms was, you know, 6 years ago, 7 years ago when I did Ofcom, there was only 3 main suppliers. And there was much less creativity and ingenuity, you know? And now it's much broader, but it's, and things are still emerging, but at least the direction is clear that there needs to be more diversity.
Makes sense. Yeah, I think we don't have too much time left, but I wanted to look forward, I guess, a little bit. So we talked about some emerging technologies. We talked about Web3, 6G, AI, quantum key distribution, to name some of them. But moving forward, what do you think are some major emerging technologies, or maybe even some like weak signals that you've been paying attention to that have the potential to have a big impact on sustainability? And then maybe for positive societal impact. So we look at the Sustainable Development Goals as an example, UN system, the poverty, hunger, water shortage, things like that. What are some emerging technologies that you think might play a big role in?
Well, I think, you know, in terms of AR or the broader XR is the thing that excites me the most, together with humanoid robotics and human-machine interfaces. And again, here, it's the technology itself can do as much bad as good. But it's really the way it's managed, if it's done conscientiously, can give a lot of productivity to everybody. But if you look at AR itself, you know, in terms of sustainability, you think about it, and everybody says to me, oh, but it's so expensive to do these AR technologies and all that. And I'm thinking, how much does it take to build a big screen, a big TV screen? And how expensive is that? How expensive are the latest OLED, you know, curved OLEDs, etc.? And how much carbon does it take to manufacture them? Whereas a digital screen, you would imagine it should be cheaper. It should be simpler. It should be faster to build. It should take up much less carbon. Digital technologies, we need to effectively solve the bottleneck. The bottleneck of digital technologies is that it's the spaghetti of the systems. We're building all these siloed into systems. So every time you want to change something in one system, you have to go and upgrade all the other systems, which then becomes prohibitively costly, and you're never going to do it. If you come to a citywide platform where you're enabling all of these, and it's an open platform, you no longer have to pay the software upgrade cost, and it's just an incremental value, then imagine what you can do. Just imagine how much carbon footprint you can save by having so much less digital screens, and instead, you know, having people using their AR glasses, which are powered by the city through wireless power, for example, you know, and having common screens where people get together. The only other thing I would add to that is that we really need to make sure that these technologies bring people together rather than separate them. This is why I've really never been a fan of VR, because it isolates you from other human beings. Whereas AR, these technologies and common screens and common areas that bring people together in common experiences, is what really excites me. And I think can certainly save a lot of energy and make things much more economically viable for normal people like you and me.
I mean, a quick footnote for anybody who might not be familiar with the abbreviations, but AR, clearly augmented reality, and VR, virtual reality. And it's a great point you made just now, Mansoor, is virtual reality is something that isolates you, as opposed to augmented reality that can help build more connection. We're coming up to the end of our time together. The way we usually end, Mansoor, is Vic and I give our key instinctive takeaways, and then we'll kick it off to you for anything that you would want to add at the end. I will start, Vic, if you don't mind. What I take away from our fascinating discussion is the huge potential for digital technologies to reshape the way we live, not just from the point of view of economic efficiency, but from the point of view of how we build our societies. And Mansoor, from the things you mentioned, what strikes me is, first of all, you know, the huge potential, the great value of experimenting in completely new cities like Neom, exactly because of the flexibility that it gives to build from scratch, the absolute importance of empowering the individuals. You mentioned the creator economy, Mansoor, and I think that the idea of really giving power to the individuals is extremely, extremely important. And for this to work, something else that you mentioned, the issue of trust, especially trust between individuals on one side and governments and institutions and corporations on the other, is fundamentally, in my mind, potentially the thorniest issue that we face looking forward. Vic, what about you?
Yeah, thanks, Marco. I guess I'm going to zoom out a bit from this particular conversation, because some of the stuff that Mansoor said tied into conversations we've had in the past. So for example, when you talked about moving away from vertical integration, it's talking about looking further into the future rather than quick and efficient. So building more for resilience rather than efficiency. And very often our systems are designed to give us, like you mentioned, bang for the buck, right? But in reality, if you want to talk about ecosystems and be sustainable, we want to be doing something that's more distributed. And the word, I guess, you use is transparency as well, which ties into community engagement. So we talk about this other feature of our society now, which is this great disconnect between how quickly populations are, with the technologies growing and the population's not able to keep up. So how do we get the information into the hands of everyone? So the ethics and the transparency and building that trust with the public in terms of emerging technologies and how it's deployed, and you know, the role of the government in ensuring that as we're developing it, we're making sure that we're engaging the public.
Mansoor, anything we left out simply what you think you really would like the audience to take away from our discussion?
Well, I could carry up for 5 hours, guys, but you've wrapped it up perfectly. I would just add that... But I think, you know, on the one hand, I've been really encouraged. You know, when I started off in NEOM, we talked about sustainability and economic development being something that goes hand in hand. You know, we were like outliers. It's been embraced the last 4 years following COVID, which is great. And I do think, though, there's still more to be done in terms of making sure that sustainability is at the center of new technologies. I think we're failing with AI and data centers. When I keep hearing people saying people investing now in data centers because we need more for the AI, we're pumping more data, but we don't actually know how these algorithms work, it's not sustainable for me. It's just not sustainable. So we need to be very careful and vigilant about what are we actually doing and what is the cost on the planet. Bitcoin is another case in point. I never invested in Bitcoin, even though it was very lucrative, because it's just a machine to create energy and to eat up the planet. So I think we still need to be vigilant. I feel that we slipped a little bit in our focus because of the economic crisis. The focus on making sure sustainability is still central to technology has slipped a little bit, and the bang for the buck is coming back in. We need to stay vigilant to make sure that we understand the values of what we're, the value beyond the wealth value alone is really important, and we shouldn't let it slip. AI needs to be looked at in great detail. There are new technologies such as neuromorphic that I'm really excited about that use a lot less energy, that mimic the human brain. So we just need to make sure that happens. And the final thing I would say is, it is a fantastic opportunity with NEOM and the cities that NEOM is building, and other cities around the GCC and Saudi Arabia in particular, who are very much backing these new technologies and sustainability as a whole. But there are learnings for all cities around the world. Not all the cities can do them all at once, but all cities can take a piece here or there and use it. And this is something I've been talking to a lot of cities from Prague to Dublin to others through various institutions such as the Cities Today Institute. And I think there's a lot of momentum about creating new working groups for 6G, for example, that take the city perspective and bring together the urban planners, the urban designers, the architects, and the construction companies together with the telecoms players to build a future of 6G at cognitive cities and technology that we can all be part of. And I think that's really exciting as well.
These are great, great points and a great place to end. Mansoor, thank you very much for being with us today and for the fantastic insights. Vic, thanks as always for being a fantastic co-host. And thanks to all of our listeners. And of course, if you've enjoyed this conversation, we welcome you to join us for more Ecosystemic Future podcasts on the Apple Podcasts platform or whatever your favorite podcast source is, or on shoshinworks.com. Thank you, everybody.
My pleasure, and thank you very much to both of you.